three men to the port side, and Takanaka led three more to the starboard stairs. 80 yards forward of their position, four fast ropes slapped onto the deck, and black-clad operators with skull-face balaclavas began sliding down to the Emerald Endeavor.
"Chief, I've got movement."
Ricks dropped to a knee on the metal landing between the main deck and the second deck, and he scanned forward, looking for any indication of the movement Greaser called out. Just 50 feet ahead of him, two men stood at the railing, looking forward at the bow. He could only see their backs at first, and he observed them as they watched the helicopter lift high into the air and peel away. Ricks knew these men had overwatch on the seals of Bravo Squad as they came up the main deck toward the superstructure. He needed to be certain neither man was armed. One of the men turned a little to the side as he lifted his Kalashnikov rifle. Its stock was folded closed, but Ricks could see a magazine in the weapon. The man pointed it toward the deck in front of him and held it away from his body awkwardly. In the span of 2 heartbeats, Chief Ricks knew the man was no soldier, and he was unsure of what he was doing, but he was a threat to the men on the deck below, nonetheless. Ricks thumbed off the safety of his M4 and fired 2 lightning-quick semi-automatic rounds. Both struck the man in the back of his head. Through his thermal, Ricks saw the black-hot signature of exploding brain matter, and then the silhouette dropped to the deck. The second man in his scope did not appear to be armed, but Ricks saw the AK had fallen right in front of him. The man looked down to it, and the moment he did so, a short burst of suppressed fire came from the chief's right. Greaser dropped the man within the weapon's reach with a trio of bullets into the back, center mass, and a second later, the 4-man fire team once again began climbing the stairs. A minute later, Ricks, Greaser, and Jones were in the dark but expansive bridge of the Emerald Endeavor. Elizondo was outside with Alpha's other fire team. They had detained 8 men who all appeared to be Malaysian or perhaps Indonesian, and they were in the process of zip-tying their wrists and arms behind their backs. Bravo team was below decks now, ferreting out crew members and securing them with ties. But Chief Ricks and the 2 men with him still had work to do. In front of them were 2 senior crewmen. Again, Ricks thought they might be Filipino or Malaysian, and 1 North Korean captain. The 2 crewmen were compliant. They stood with their back to the helm and their hands high. But the gray-haired captain was shouting wildly and swinging a rigging knife with a 4-inch blade back and forth, waving it at the armed men in the skull masks in front of him. Ricks had given the order to hold fire unless absolutely necessary. He knew they needed the captain's help to quickly inspect the cargo. Using the few Korean words he had learned, he said,
"Nuo,
lie down," over and over, holding his carbine at the ready with 1 hand while making a downward gesture with his gloved left hand. Ricks's attempt at breaching the vast cultural divide here on the bridge was getting nowhere. Out of desperation, he pulled down his mask, smiled, and said, "Annyeong," hello, because it was just about the only nice thing he'd learned to say in the language. Still, he kept the muzzle of his Colt M4 directed at the man's chest. The captain continued swinging the knife around, and his panic remained.
"Nuo,"
Ricks said again, imploring the man to lie down, but he could see it in the man's eyes. He wasn't going to lie down. He was psyching himself up for something. Ricks kept his calm countenance going, but into his mic he said, "He takes 2 steps our way and we drop him." "Roger that," came the call back from Greaser and Jones. The captain took 2 steps, but backward, not forward. Then he brought the rigging knife over his throat. Ricks shouted,
"Anyo! Anyo!" "No! No!"
The little gray-haired man screamed, then dragged the shiny blade across his throat. Blood appeared instantly, along with the gurgling sound of the breach of his airway. Ricks watched in fascinated horror as the captain finished his deep cut. Then he seemed to look down at the spurting blood coming from him.
Fuck!
Shouted Greaser, just behind Rix, and he started to move forward.
Stand fast, shouted the chief. Wait for him to...
The knife fell from the captain's hands, and he crumpled back onto the deck between the helm and the pilot chair.
Secure that blade, Chief Rix ordered now,
and Greaser leapt forward, kicked the knife out of reach, and then he pinned the wounded captain down to the deck. He rolled him over and pulled out a zip tie from his load-bearing vest to tie the captain's wrists.
Rix turned to the medic of the squad, SO3 Joseph Jones. Jojo, do what you can for him.
Rix said this even though he knew without a blood transfusion and surgery, the captain didn't have a prayer, and the chances of those happening here were zero. The captain died quickly. Even though the medic slid a tube into the wound to keep an airway going, there was no way to stop the blood loss in time to save the small man. Rix stood over him the entire time, but his attention was split between the activity at his feet on the deck and the constant updates on his radio. Bravo and Fireteam 2 of Alpha had rounded up the 12 surviving crew members on board. All of them had been searched and zipped and put on the main deck just forward of the superstructure. They were all guarded by SEALs. Jones covered the dead captain's body with a body bag out of his pack. Greaser stood next to Rix and looked down at the dead man.
Chief, I'm going to go way out on a limb and say we've got ourselves some contraband on this ship.
You think? Rix replied. He called Takanaka, the radio man of the squad, and told him to get on the horn with the Freedom and tell them the ship was secure. Hendricks, Elizondo, Parnell, and Stovall joined the others on the bridge, and they looked down at the body under the green plastic bag.
You had to smoke him? Hendricks asked.
Greaser answered for his chief. He smoked himself. Slit his own fucking throat.
Holy shit. Why'd he do that?
Rix answered matter-of-factly, because he didn't want to defect to the evil West, and slitting his own throat was better than going back home. For his failure, he would have fared even worse there. Parnell said, there ain't a lot worse than gagging on your own blood. Rix looked up at Parnell, then at the rest of his men.
I read a thing a few months back. A DPRK major was suspected of giving intel to the South Koreans. He probably didn't do it, but he was suspected. The government took him out and executed him.
The men waited for the punchline. They were all pretty sure it wasn't going to be funny.
Rix said, with a goddamn flamethrower.
They tossed that poor son of a bitch into a dirt pit and barbecued his ass. Took their time with it, too.
Jesus Christ, mumbled Stovall.
Rix said, on interdictions in these waters, we are engaging a uniquely motivated enemy. They are desperate men with their backs to the wall. Rix fingered his skull-face balaclava and raised his Colt rifle.
We think we're a bunch of terrifying motherfuckers. But don't forget, we don't scare anybody out here.
They've seen worse. 24 Marines stationed on the USS Freedom arrived on the Emerald Endeavor within 20 minutes. Rix figured these kids, their average age was about 20, wished they'd had the chance to be involved in the raid, the shooting and scooting. In comparison, going through the cargo holds and containers of the big ship would be dull work, but at least it got them off the other boat for a few hours. They found what they were looking for after 90 minutes. Cargo holds 1 through 4 all contained 80-pound sacks of unrefined sugar with the markings of a Cuban agricultural entity. Hold 7 contained the same thing. But holds 5 and 6, just 4 of the center of the ship, contained stacks of 40-foot containers. When the Marines broke open the doors of the locked containers, they saw they were piled high with various machine parts. The equipment looked like plumbing and air conditioning equipment and parts of an old boiler. It was all used and rusted and broken, certainly not equipment one would ship around the world. But after a half hour of pulling out big hunks of metal equipment, the Marines came upon large aluminum tubes in fiberglass casing. There were no markings on the cases, but the tubes were some 6.5 feet in diameter and 18 feet in length. The Marines found only two before the ship was brought into port in Incheon, but when inspected fully, a half dozen precision aluminum tubes were found, along with sophisticated plastic crating containing precision-crafted O-rings and coupling bolts. The young Marines had suspected it from the beginning, but the experts in South Korea confirmed the find. These were the hollow stages of an intercontinental ballistic missile, and they corresponded in diameter to the Taepodong-2, North Korea's still unsuccessful longest-range nuclear delivery vehicle. Determining where all this equipment came from was the next order of business for the intelligence organizations of the West. Chapter 17. French intelligence operative Veronica Martel climbed out of a taxi on the corner of 88th and Columbus and began walking east in the rain. Her black umbrella protected her from the downpour, but it also helped her blend in with the other pedestrians, many of whom were under black umbrellas themselves. Martel had no real reason to run a surveillance detection route here on the Upper West Side of New York City. It wasn't like she was in Tripoli or Bucharest or Dubrovnik. She wasn't even on the job at the moment. But SDRs were part of Martel's life. She'd learned to leave nothing to chance, to expect every opportunity to turn into a potential for danger, to concern herself with the minutiae of her tradecraft to keep herself safe. The reasons for her concerns about everyone and everything all boiled down to a simple explanation. Veronica Martel did not trust the world. Even though her SDR took her north, south, east, and west through the rainy mid-morning streets of one of the most congested metropolises on Earth, she arrived at the offices of Sharp's global intelligence partners at 10 a.m., exactly on time. After a quick security check by a guard who met her in the ground floor lobby of the building, the two of them took the elevator up 5 stories, and the door opened on the marble foyer of the executive office of the nation's most successful corporate intelligence concern. A guard force of 6 men manned the lobby. They all wore business suits and earpieces and salt-and-pepper hair over physiques that were still hardened from physical activity, making the men appear at once both distinguished and dangerous. Martel knew these guards were all ex-military, just like the force at her satellite office in Belgium, and just like the guard forces at all 26 SAT offices around the globe. The men were polite and professional, but they all leered at her. Martel had come to expect this from men, and as always, it only stood to make her both uncomfortable and annoyed. She didn't come to New York often, and she had not seen Wayne Sharps since the day he hired her 3 years earlier. She was virtually always in the field, and she liked it that way. But she'd been summoned by the director of her company, and she knew the value of showing her face around the home office once in a while to remind the execs who she was. She felt like she knew the reason behind her summons. The operation in Ho Chi Minh City 2 weeks earlier had been an odd one. The North Koreans' presence at the safe house, the Australians and their trepidation about what they had gotten themselves into, the American asset refusing to hand over the package, and the blood on the document, indicating it had been taken by force. Veronica knew she had done everything correctly, just as instructed, nothing more, nothing less. She wasn't in any trouble. She thought they were just bringing her in for consultations, to make certain she was comfortable with everything, or at least comfortable enough to keep her mouth shut and her head down. And Veronica had no problem with that at all.
She was escorted into Wayne Sharpe's office by a secretary who Martell thought too young and attractive to have earned her position through merit alone, and once inside, she took in the view. The fifth-story corner office had floor-to-ceiling windows that looked out to Columbus Avenue and 77th, presenting a stellar vista of the American Museum of Natural History across the street. Sharpe himself sat behind his large desk with his feet up. He was on the phone, speaking Arabic, and speaking it well, Martell noted. She sat down on a modern sectional sofa in a sunken seating area across the large office. Tea and coffee were placed in front of her, but she instead just looked at the sofa. Duke Sharpe's was known as particularly lecherous, and Veronica wondered how many women the 60-year-old man had taken right here in his office. She pushed the thought out of her mind. If he tried anything on her, she'd send him headfirst out the window and down into Columbus Avenue traffic. Finally, he hung up the phone and spun the chair around, a little too dramatically as far as Veronica was concerned. He crossed the room as she stood from the sofa. He was burly, but not unattractive, though his face had leathered noticeably in the 3 years since she'd last seen him in person. "My dear Ms. Martell," he said with a wide grin.
"Lovely to see you, Mr. Sharpe's."
"It's Duke to you," he said.
"It's Duke to everyone," she thought to herself.
"Veronica," she replied, because she felt she had to, not because she liked the familiarity. She was European, after all, and normal Europeans rarely addressed business colleagues by their given names. Moreover, Veronica Martell was not normal. She preferred keeping everyone at arm's length. They sat down, and Sharpe's poured coffee for Veronica without asking, even though she would have preferred tea. He asked her about her trip over, about the office back in Belgium she was based out of, and about a job she had done in Paris recently involving a city administrator and a problem with his daughter. It was a small-time operation, nothing that would be brought to Duke's attention since, at any one time, his company employed hundreds of operatives on dozens and dozens of missions. To Veronica, it seemed as if he had just been brushing up on her file while she rode the elevator to his office. After the small talk, Sharpe's got down to business. "Veronica, I read the reports. You were stellar on that job in Vietnam. You were one of my bright lights here in the corporation. I expect you to go far." She smiled dryly. She didn't tell him about the blood on the passport. She didn't have a clue if he already knew about it, but she wouldn't bring it up, because she was, in fact, a bright light. She was an operative who did her job and kept her mouth shut. She thought he would next show some contrition for the complications of the mission. But instead, Sharpe said, "I was lucky to steal you away from DGSE." Veronica paused to regroup. Then she responded with typical coyness.
"You weren't lucky. You were wealthy. That stole me away. Plus the fact that I'd been fired from DGSE and had few other options."
He hesitated with a slightly open mouth, trying to decide how to take her comment. Apparently he took it as a joke, because he laughed boisterously. "Despite your problems in France, you didn't come cheap, that's for damn certain. But you are worth every last cent."
"I do try to create value for myself."
He nodded aggressively and repositioned himself on the sofa. Surprised by the movement, Veronica thought he was going to try and slide closer to her, but instead he just crossed his legs. She was uncertain if her surprised look had scared him off at the last second. After a moment, he said, "I have a new assignment for you. I expect it to last a few weeks in duration, though it might run over just a tad."
"That is fine."
"It's a continuation of what you did in Vietnam."
"Oh?"
"I'll give you the background you didn't have when you started this op.
The North Koreans have discovered a huge deposit of rare earth minerals. I guess I should say the Chinese have discovered it, but that lunatic Choi has kicked out the Chinese, and now North Korea will continue operations on their own. Veronica said, "A nation that can't feed their people or keep their lights on is entering into the high-tech mining sector alone? If they really could do it alone, they wouldn't need us." "No, they are not alone. Our client isn't North Korea. That would be illegal, of course. Our client is New World Metals, LLC, a completely above-board mining consortium from Mexico via a dozen shell companies. They have a wholly legitimate contract to partner in the mining concern as a third party." Veronica was bored, and she let Sharps know. "My assignment? You are going to California." She sat up straighter on the sofa. That sounded nice. A hell of a lot better than Vietnam, anyway. The North Koreans don't trust the Chinese to process the ore once they dig it out of the mountains. This presents a serious problem, because the processing of rare earth materials is particularly complicated, and special equipment and know-how is required. New World Metals has purchased the computers for the processing equipment from Europe, and they will fly them into North Korea via Bulgaria, but without proprietary software, they are useless. They have asked us to send someone to Valley Floor, a Newcorp rare earth mine in California, and obtain the proprietary software they are using on the computers in their processing plant there. California, to Veronica Martell, meant Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco or Rodeo Drive in Los Angeles. Wayne Sharps seemed to be describing a strip mine somewhere far away from these locations. Still, she was a dutiful employee. "Okay, Duke. What specifically do you need me to do?" "We need the software, every last bit of it. You will get it." "Of course." He moved again on the sofa, and this time there was no question. He was coming closer. She stood up quickly. He just smiled. It was clear to Veronica that he had expected her reaction, and it didn't bother him at all. She took him for a man much more thrilled by the chase than the kill, and she knew she had just thrilled him greatly. He did not miss a beat, continuing as if nothing had happened. He stood up as well. "Your contact will be Edward Riley. Know him?" She raised an eyebrow. "The scandal in Italy?" "Right. That's in his past. He's a good man. A Brit, but we won't hold it against him. He's running the entire New World Metals operation from stem to stern. We are positioning you as a quality assurance officer from the Canadian company that manufactures some of the processing equipment. You will be there to run some diagnostics on the machines and to survey the operation. This will put you in contact with the software we need." "Fine," she said. Duke smiled at her. "It was nice to see you. Until we meet again." He shook her hand, then held it. He hesitated, and she knew what was coming. Some sort of verbal attempt to hit on her, since his physical approach had failed. She expected it to be overt and charmless. She was right. "Your coldness only enhances your sex appeal. Has anyone ever said that?" "Certainly not to my face, Duke." She pulled her hand back with a smile, turned away, and left his office, aware of his eyes on her every step of the way. Chapter 18. President of the United States Jack Ryan would have normally called in his entire National Security Council to discuss a situation as important as the capture of the material for weapons of mass destruction on its way to North Korea, and he had intended to do just that. But when his chief of staff, Arnie Van Dam, contacted both Director of National Intelligence, Mary Pat Foley, and Director of the CIA, J. Canfield, he
He'd received requests from both to delay the meeting for a few hours while they worked on something that would be crucial to providing the president with a bigger and better picture of what was going on. One does not normally tell POTUS no when he asks for a meeting, but Van Damme knew Ryan would have no problem allowing his top intelligence community officials more time to do necessary work, so he pushed the meeting back until 9 a.m. the next day. The only problem with this from a scheduling standpoint was that the president had to fly to London for a NATO conference on Russia first thing in the morning. They could have conducted the meeting via video conference, as Air Force One had the secure telecom necessary to keep the president in touch with Washington wherever he flew, but Mary Pat made the last-minute decision to go to Andrews early in the morning and fly along to Europe with her president so she could present her material in person. Mary Pat had known Jack for more than 30 years, and more than any public figure she had ever worked with. She knew how much he enjoyed rolling up his sleeves and putting his hands on the intelligence itself. She had an objective with today's meeting, and she knew she'd get a lot further with POTUS if he understood and agreed with all the intelligence she presented, and taking the flights to London and back would be a small price to pay for having his undivided attention for an hour or so. Ryan agreed to the private conference with Mary Pat in the president's office on Air Force One. The full National Security Council meeting could wait. For now. As the plane taxied to the runway, Ryan sat at his desk working on some early morning paperwork. He heard a knock at the open door next to him, and he looked up to see Arnie Van Damme. "Aren't you supposed to strap in for takeoff?" Ryan asked. "Aren't you?" Ryan's desk chair had a seat belt, but it dangled off the side. He said, "I've been doing this so long I have it down to a science. Right when I hear us go throttle up, I buckle up and clear my desk." He snatched his coffee cup with a smile. "Then I grab my coffee so it doesn't spill." Van Damme entered the room and sat in the chair across from the desk. It, too, had a seat belt. "For a guy who hates flying, I'd say you've got the hang of it." Ryan just chuckled and looked back down to his papers. He could tell they were still taxiing and would be for another few minutes. "What's up?" Arnie said, "Secret Service wants to talk to you again about Mexico City." Ryan shook his head without looking up. "We've talked. I'm not canceling. They need to drop it." Arnie was the only member of Ryan's staff who regularly argued with his boss. "I think you should reconsider. We've got some outs. Don't worry about that. Lots of problems in Asia and Ukraine that need attention. President Lopez will forgive you if you send regrets." Now Ryan did look up. "No, Arnie. I'm going." "What Secret Service's specific argument against the trip?" "Well, I think they want to talk to you to make their case in person." "I'm asking you." "It's the Maldonado thing." The president waved it away. "That was 6 months ago." "They're concerned that..." Ryan called out to the hallway next to his office. "Andrea, can you come in here a second?" His lead protection agent, Andrea Price O'Day, was in the room in 2 seconds. "Yes, sir." "I'd like to ask you to pistol whip Arnie for me, but I bet you'll give me some song and dance about you having rules against that." Andrea laughed and looked to Van Damme. "How about I just keep a close eye on him for now? He looks pretty harmless." Ryan said, "What's this about you guys not wanting me to go to Mexico?" Andrea replied, "That's not me, Mr. President. I understand our Threats and Assessment Advanced Division had some concerns." Ryan shrugged. "So, as far as you're concerned, I should go?" "Didn't say that either. As far as I'm concerned, you'd never leave the White House. But it's not my call to make, Mr. President." Ryan drummed his fingers on his desk for a moment. Then he said, "I'm going. I don't duck and cover because some Mexican cartel psycho scumbag in the mountains goes on Twitter and threatens me. The office of the president is too important to show any reaction to a two-bit thug like that." Arnie said, "But..." Ryan cut him off. "If Secret Service wants a meeting, I'll give it to them. but only out of respect. I have no plans of canceling that trip. Tell them that. Maybe they can save us both some time. He looked at Andrea. She nodded. As far as she was concerned, the matter was settled. I'll be right there with you. Then everything will be fine. O'Day returned to her seat, and Ryan looked back to Arnie. We're about 5 seconds from throttle up. You'd better fasten your seatbelt. Both men reached for their seatbelts just as the massive 747 began to vibrate. Right after takeoff at 7:15 a.m., Ryan sent down for his intelligence chief, who was just finishing an apple bran muffin and a cup of coffee in the senior staff meeting room while she worked on her iPad. She climbed the steps to the president's office and found Ryan sitting behind his desk. He wore a dress shirt and a tie, but over that he wore his dark blue Air Force One flight jacket. He beckoned her over to a small rectangular conference table and grabbed a stack of papers from his desk. When he started to a chair opposite her, she reached out and pulled the chair around to her side of the table. "Mind if we sit next to each other? I have to show you some things on my tablet." "As long as it doesn't get back to Ed," he joked. Mary Pat laughed, and they both sat down. More coffee was poured for them while they got settled. Ryan asked, "Have you seen the reaction from the North Koreans about the interdiction of the Emerald Endeavor?" Foley shook her head. "I missed it. I haven't had a chance to turn on the TV." Ryan said, "Any guesses as to the wording?" "Well, I don't know. Something like, this illegal interdiction is an act of war perpetrated by America." Ryan looked down at this morning's presidential daily brief, which contained an abbreviated transcript of the North Korean ambassador's remarks from the evening before. He read it silently, then said, "Pretty good, Mary Pat." He read from the transcript. "We regard this unlawful interception by the U.S. as an act of war." Mary Pat waved away Ryan's compliment. "Easy guess. It's always the same with these guys." "So what do we know about the material found? Definitely components to a missile." "Definitely. These tubes are the exact specs of a Dongfeng 3A. It is a Chinese single-stage medium-range nuclear ballistic missile." Ryan was confused. "Chinese? That doesn't make sense. The Chinese could truck them over the border. Why would they sail them out into international waters where they could be interdicted?" Foley replied, "The Chinese didn't make them or deliver them." "But you just said these are knockoffs." Jack cocked his head. "Counterfeit?" "Yes. They are exact reproductions of the tubes used for the fuselage of the DF-3A Chinese medium-range missiles. But these were made by a private aerospace company in France called Précision Aéro Toulouse." "That's interesting. Why?" "The theory we have is this. We all know the North Koreans are having problems fielding a long-range ICBM because their Taipodong 2, the closest one they have to being ready, keeps failing, either between first and second stage or between second and third stage separation. That means something could be wrong with the second stage they're using."
"Right. Go on."
Mary Pat slid her iPad along the table to where Jack could see it, and she began scrolling through several photos and diagrams of missiles. Each picture was labeled and time-stamped and captioned, and Ryan saw some of the photos were from open-source intel, and others were from top-secret sources. "The second stage they're using now is taken from their Rodong medium-range ballistic missile. Basically, they just slapped a single-stage rocket into the middle of their three-stage rocket, and it's not working out for them."
"Imagine that."
"Rocket science is tough," Mary Pat said with a chuckle. "But what we know is the Chinese are doing something similar with their long-range missiles. They use their Dongfeng 3A single-stage rocket as the second stage of their long-range ICBM."
"And the North Koreans want to use the Dongfeng on their Taipodong 2?
"It appears so. Back in the early 90s, the Chinese gave the North Koreans one Dongfeng 3A missile. They never deployed it,
They just took it apart to cobble pieces together in their own equipment. Now that China has refused to give Choi the ICBM technology that he wants, we think they're using this French aerospace firm to build replicas of the Dongfeng 3A. Off Chinese plans, Ryan asked. We don't think so. We think this company in France actually re-engineered these missile components by using the tube of the one Dongfeng 3A in the North Koreans' possession. Jack looked over the photos of the tubes pulled off the Emerald Endeavor. Wow. Mary Pat said, wow is right. In order to re-engineer these tubes, they would have had to have built proprietary tools and high-tech machines. Ryan said the obvious, and that didn't come cheap. Not cheap at all. We've spent the past couple of days looking into this. Precision Aero received a payment of 17 million euros 8.5 months ago. That's nearly 25 million U.S. dollars. Ryan sipped his coffee. Should it bother us? North Korea has 25 million U.S. to drop on a project as speculative as this? It bothers me. We don't know what all they expected for that payment, or what all Precision Aero has already shipped them. We need to find out. Have we talked with the French government? No, and there's a problem with doing that. We need to go carefully so they don't know we're looking into the bank accounts of one of their companies. Anyway, I know what they'll say. The deal wasn't done with the North Koreans. It was with a shell company out of Luxembourg. Ryan sighed, looking again at the tubes taken from the Emerald Endeavor. This equipment must violate international non-proliferation treaties. That's debatable. Ryan turned to Mary Pat, and she put her hands up quickly. I'm not debating it. Of course the commerce in these kinds of dual-use parts should be banned by international treaty, but companies make the argument that as long as it is not overtly going to end users who are going to make ICBMs, then it should be fair game. There are enough private satellite companies on Earth today to where firms like Precision Aero can dip their toe into weapons proliferation with plausible deniability. Ryan rubbed his eyes under his glasses. I'll call the French president and let him know what we know. I'll play it like we got tipped off. He might not believe me, but he won't be able to challenge me. Foley said, the real issue here, Mr. President, is not the material we found on board the Emerald Endeavor. It's the fact North Korea had the hard currency to buy this material on the world market in the first place. I can tell by that look on your face, you know something. I do. CIA has been working on North Korean banking practices for a while now, and this fits right in with this new information. We traced the payment to Precision Aero back to a bank account in Dubai. There was 13 million in the account, even after the purchase. What is North Korea doing with that kind of cash? We have a theory, and this is why Jay and I weren't able to meet with you yesterday. We've been working on this for 3 days solid, even before the Emerald Endeavor. Ryan leaned closer. Tell me. Mr. President, there is strong evidence North Korea has restarted production on their rare earth mineral mine at Cheongju. Ryan just said, shit. Mary Pat continued, analysts at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency say there are indications that the rare earth mine in the northwest of the nation is up and running again. Further, they think it is happening without Chinese help. Ryan said, the Chinese were booted from that mine a few months back. A year ago now, yes. Our contacts in China report no change in that relationship, so we find it curious the North Koreans are advancing with the program there. Especially because there is evidence they are actually building up the capacity to process the rare earth ore into refined materials. That's something light years ahead of the current level of DPRK sophistication. Even the Chinese had planned on processing the ore at refineries in China.
Do the Chinese know the DPRK is going around them?
Virtually all of what we know about facts on the ground in North Korea comes from the Chinese. Either intercepted communications, the odd human asset, or open sources. We see nothing about Chungju in any of these resources, so we feel the Chinese are in the dark on this, for now at least.
Ryan asked, "Do you have the NGA images?"
Mary Pat had learned long ago to expect Ryan to ask to see primary intelligence. She began flipping pages on her tablet, displaying a series of overhead shots of a cluster of buildings.
"What do you think?" Mary Pat asked after a moment.
"I think I'm glad we've got analysts at NGA to decipher this for us. I see the strip mine, obviously, but all the tanks and buildings look like they could belong to just about any sort of factory."
Mary Pat reached to the tablet computer and brought up another page. On it were two images. One was captioned Chungju Dam, and the other, Lamp.
"The one on the left is the ore processing facility in North Korea. We are calling it Chungju Dam because that is the closest named structure. It's just north of Chungju and west of the mine. And the image here is of the Lamp rare earth processing plant in Malaysia. Look at the oxidation tanks in both photos."
Ryan looked them over and agreed. The two installations were very similar.
Mary Pat said, "We learned from Chinese intercepts last year that Chungju could bring North Korea as much as $12 trillion in hard assets in the next 2 to 3 decades. With that kind of a potential haul, it's no big surprise they found someone new to help them build and run it."
Ryan said, "And that someone new is paying them in hard currency for the opportunity. And that connects this to the missile tubes on the Emerald Endeavor."
Foley nodded.
"Right.
The North Koreans are taking the offshore money they're getting for future mineral rights, and they are using it to buy the ballistic missile technology they need to make their ICBMs operational, because the one thing they do not yet have is an ICBM that can reach the continental United States."
Ryan almost mumbled to himself, "A matter of time."
"Yes, it is a cold fact of economics that if North Korea manages to earn just a fraction of the money we think they can earn from that rare earth mineral mine, then they will be able to buy the technology and expertise they need to threaten us."
Ryan said, "So often in diplomacy, there's a tendency to oversimplify things. Most situations are not the zero-sum games people make them out to be. But this is one such case. Success for North Korea means failure for us. We stop the mining, and we stop the spigot of cash that's fueling their missile program."
"Exactly.
But as long as North Korea has access to banks where they can transact with shell companies for hard currency, we won't be able to stop them."
Jack looked out the porthole next to him. They were just off the coast of Maine, heading northeast. The Atlantic looked impossibly blue below.
"We're not going to fire cruise missiles into North Korea to destroy a strip mine. We just have to find out who in the West is bankrolling them and how they're doing it."
"The how is no problem. CIA has compiled a list of 30 banks in 10 nations where we have found North Korean offshore accounts."
"Where are they?"
She looked down at her iPad and found a file, then opened it and read aloud. "Hong Kong, Vanuatu, Brunei, Singapore, Mexico, Switzerland, Malta, Belize, Nicaragua, and the Cayman Islands."
"Not necessarily places we can apply direct pressure to get the assets frozen."
"Not at all."
Frustrated, Ryan said, "What about identifying who is working with North Korea on the mine?"
"Easier said than done, Mr. President. This transaction with Precision Aero is a dead end. It won't lead back to the actual mining partners. It only leads to a shell company, which I'm sure was set up by the North Koreans to procure overseas equipment for their missile program."
Jack turned and looked at his DNI with a grave face.
"Mary Pat, I do hate to sound like a broken record,
but you know what I'm going to say.
You want me to get you more information?
He nodded. However you can. A North Korea with an ICBM that can reach the U.S. is a game changer. Not just in Asia, but in the entire planet. We can't punish the North for violating sanctions because we are already doing that. I might be able to push the UN for a new round of sanctions that will squeeze their accounts in those offshore banks, but that's a long shot and it won't happen overnight. But if you can find out who is helping them with their rare earth mine, I will go after them with a vengeance, and that will at least slow down their new source of income. Mary Pat saw the task before her as nearly impossible, but she had her assignment from her superior. Yes, Mr. President. Chapter 19 Lieutenant General Ri Tae-jin flew via helicopter to the Kongdong Airport, just northeast of Pyongyang. With him were 8 subordinates and a security detail of 8 more, most of whom were flying in a follow-on helo. The 2 Russian-made MI-8s touched down at noon, and Ri stepped out moments later, only to climb into the back of a waiting Mercedes limousine. The bulk of his entourage boarded military vehicles, and they set off for their destination. Kongdong was a suburb of sprawling Pyongyang, only 30 miles from Choi Li Hung Square, the center of the capital city. But Choi Ji-hoon had a second palatial residence here, and when he was at Kongdong-gun, anyone who was summoned had to make the 2-hour drive on poor roads, unless, of course, they were high-ranking government or military personnel, at which point they could simply fly. The North Korean state had an official policy of Songun, which meant military first. It was government doctrine that the Chosun Imingun was fed first, fed best, housed and outfitted using the pick of the nation's resources. Most party officials reached their status via their military careers, and many high-ranking government department heads were still Chosun Imingun. High-ranking military personnel had access to helicopters, and when they drove on the roads, they could order the roads blocked from ordinary civilians. Songun made the military the elite social class of the nation. Ri's flight was only 10 minutes, and his limo ride was only 20 more, and this brought him through the checkpoints on the grounds of the luxury mansion and to the front door. He was brought into a small banquet hall by a half-dozen men of Section 5 of the party's Central Committee Guidance Department. They were Choi's close protection detail, and they treated Ri with politeness, but no real deference. His body was wanded, and he was seated at a small table and brought tea. Here he waited 1 hour and 23 minutes. He made no complaints and displayed no show of frustration, because Section 5 stood at parade rest around the room, and they kept their eyes on him. Finally, Choi walked in, and Ri immediately stood and fought off the natural desire to wince. The Daewon Su's Mao jacket was half open, and his eyes were bloodshot. Choi's hair was cut too short to show dishevelment, but Ri could see creases on the young man's face that gave clues the man had been lying on a bed moments before. His fleshy cheeks were pinker than usual as well. Ri realized almost instantly that the Daewon Su was drunk. He'd seen his nation's leader in various levels of inebriation before. Festive galas were thrown with some regularity, mostly at Ryongsung, and Ri was occasionally ordered to attend. Choi had the habit of arriving late, but always with a drink in his hand, and it was usually abundantly clear he had begun his revelry hours before. He'd never fallen over or passed out like many other officials during the festivities, but it was par for the course to see him slumped and sullen at his grand table while the party continued around him. No, Ri wasn't surprised to see his leader drinking and affected by it, but he was disheartened because he knew why he was here, and a drunk Dae Won-soo was only going to make this conversation more volatile. The Americans had foiled his attempt to bring in precision-crafted second-stage tubes from France. Reese still had time to make it happen before the clock ran out on Choi's arbitrary timetable, and with more money coming in from Oscar Robles than Reese knew what to do with, he had other opportunities to get the tubes. But he worried Choi would lose confidence in him and sack him right here and now. The lieutenant general knew good and well that Dae Won-soo wouldn't have to keep to his end of their 3-year deal. He could change his mind on a whim and throw him to the dogs at any time. Choi sat down at the table while giving Ri a distracted nod, and then, after the long protocol of deep and obligatory bows, Ri sat back down. Choi swirled the dark brandy around in his glass for a moment. He seemed to be concentrating on the spiraling movement of the liquid. The general thought his leader would say something slurred and nonsensical, but when he spoke, his voice was clear, and his words were lucid and biting. "Another shipment has been interdicted, towed to port in Incheon. How far back does this put us?" Ri kept his chin up. He'd been summoned to this meeting first thing this morning, which meant he'd had all day to prepare. "It was unfortunate. The American warship USS Freedom is making things difficult for us in acquiring the larger items we need. Smaller equipment can travel by aircraft, and we have utilized this method with good results. It is only on the sea where we are still having problems."
"The problem is America," Choi said.
"Exactly correct, Dae Won-soo. The other nations in the UN are not pursuing interdiction. Even before the return of Jack Ryan to the White House, the former president, Ed Kilty, had not harassed our shipments nearly to the extent we are seeing now."
"So the problem is Jack Ryan specifically?"
"Again, this is true. But not to worry. We have ordered more rocket tubes. They are being built by another company in Russia. It will take 6 months for delivery, but we will have everything else in place by the time they arrive, and I feel sure the Taipodong 2 will be operational well within my window for success in the mission." In truth, the Russians would ship him nothing until he paid them, and he could not pay them until Robles delivered his 500 million. This wouldn't happen till Huang's damn rare earth processing plant went live. Ri troubled Choi with none of these additional details. Choi just asked, "Won't the Americans capture the next ship like they did with this one?" Ri smiled. His sad eyes did not brighten, but the smile was there. "The Russians have an aircraft, the AN-225, that is large enough to transport the tubes by air. We won't have to worry about maritime interdiction."
"You have less than 2 years."
"Yes, Dae Won-soo. I am aware. President Jack Ryan has 2 years left in his term." "I am aware of this as well, Dae Won-soo. If not for him, we would be operational much faster." "Your predecessor had many complaints about Jack Ryan as well." Choi drank a long gulp of brandy.
"I called them excuses."
Ri realized he needed to create distance between himself and his predecessor, so as to keep distance between himself and the kennels at Chongjin. "I will not use them as excuses. Ryan is a problem, but we will succeed nonetheless." Choi looked across the table for a moment. His eyes were dull from the drink, but they did not waver.
"What do you know about Rangoon?"
Ri knew Choi wasn't asking him what he knew about the capital of Myanmar, but instead about a particular event that happened there. When North Korean leadership spoke of Rangoon to the intelligence community, it could mean only one thing,
because of the importance of the city to his nation's intelligence agency. Rhee answered with confidence. October 9th, 1983. I was a lieutenant in the Chosun Imingun at the time. I will never forget learning of the bravery of our men who... Choi talked over him as if Rhee were not speaking. October 9th, 1983. My grandfather sent three assassins to plant a bomb to kill the president of South Korea during his visit to the Martyrs' Mausoleum in Burma. The bomb missed Chun Doo-hwan, lamentably, because his motorcade had been delayed by traffic. Rhee knew all of this, of course. 21 people had been killed, 46 wounded. He did not know why Choi was bringing up this 30-year-old event. Choi said, "As an expert on history, I cannot help but think about what might have been. If Rangoon had succeeded, South Korea would have been destabilized. Our army was better than theirs. America's will would have faltered. My grandfather would have taken the entire peninsula within 1, perhaps 2 years, and we would have been in a position of incredible strength, economic strength. Military strength. The problems of the famine during the 1990s would have never occurred. The United States would have realized the pressure and sanctions were futile. Just think where we would be today if there had been a little less traffic on the road that afternoon in Rangoon." Choi smiled wistfully. General Rhee nodded. Undoubtedly, some of Choi's conclusions were sound. And undoubtedly those that were not sound would not be mentioned by Rhee. "You see what else would have happened?" Choi asked. "I am sorry. I confess I do not. My father would not have been killed by Jack Ryan." "Your father?" "The Americans poisoned my father. How else to explain it? He was a healthy man. Hard of hearing, maybe, but his doctors say he would have lived another 20 to 25 years in good health." Rhee didn't believe this was true for an instant, though he had no doubt believing the elder Choi's doctors would have made the claim he had been poisoned to deflect blame on themselves. Rhee was the operations chief of RGB when Choi's father died, and he and his people were ordered to find evidence of an assassination. Rhee found no such evidence, because no such evidence existed. Choi went back to Rangoon. "My grandfather's bravery in ordering this attack on the leader of the South was only matched by his forward thinking. Just consider it for a moment, Rhee." Rhee couldn't help but think the three assassins were the real brave ones, braver than the man who sent them down with orders to kill themselves after the attack. But of course he made no mention of this. Choi finished his drink, and a beautiful young girl, Rhee did not think she could have been more than 17, walked across the empty banquet room with a crystal flask and refilled Choi's snifter. Choi did not regard her. Instead, he kept talking. "If Rangoon had succeeded, it would have changed the fate of our nation. Indeed, the fate of the world." Rhee bowed. "Yes." "If you were able to eliminate Jack Ryan, I feel certain this would have a similar outcome for our nation. Do you agree?" Rhee's heart sank. He was being given another impossible task. But he said, "Yes, I agree wholeheartedly." Choi said, "I know the difficult thing is to make it look like someone else is involved." Choi leaned forward halfway across the table. Rhee caught the unmistakable smell of brandy, not from the snifter in his hand, but from his skin. "But that is your problem." An uncomfortable silence told General Rhee that it was his turn to talk. "Yes." "Well, Certainly there are many who would benefit from his death.
Of course. How would you do it?
Ree blinked. He needed to say something to bolster Choi's confidence in him. He tried to show no doubt, no hesitation. He spoke off the top of his head, fighting for the words just as they came out of his mouth. I would find out his foreign travel schedule. I would use Middle Eastern bomb makers. I have access to them through our good relations with Syria and Iran. I would organize the affair through proxies. He hastened to add, but I would be involved with every aspect of it, because there could be no failure. Jack Ryan is well protected now, but if there is a credible attempt on his life, the Americans can do so much more to keep away from assassins. There will be no second opportunity.
Choi nodded thoughtfully.
Ree worried he was about to order him to proceed, so he spoke quickly, couching his words of warning in layer over layer of deference, lest he offend the Daewon Su. I am certain you are aware of this, because of your astute knowledge of world history, and I only bring this up to remind myself of the stakes of any such operation. But there is the need to remember how America reacts to insult, threat, and attack. Pearl Harbor is but one example. As the Japanese Marshal Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto said, they awoke a sleeping giant. America will look long and hard for the perpetrators of the act, and if they suspect for an instant we are the perpetrators, then they will seek revenge on our soil. Ree had hoped that would sink in for a moment, but Choi waved the threat away with his brandy snifter, sloshing some of the drink out of the ball-shaped glass and onto the table. Your Middle Eastern bomber should not survive to talk. Choi smiled as if he had solved all the problems and issues with one brilliant sentence. Ree worked hard to match his leader's smile with one of his own. Yes, Daewon Su, that is an excellent idea.
Chapter 20 Londoner Edward Riley didn't much care for New York, as it was not his home. But since his home didn't much care for him, he'd relocated here to the States 5 years earlier, and he was bloody well determined to make the best of it. Part and parcel of making the best of it included the vehicle in which Riley now drove as he motored down the West Side Highway through mid-morning traffic. It was a coal-black BMW i8 electric sports car. It shined as if he'd coated it with cooking spray before leaving his garage, and its lean aerodynamic form turned heads and earned whistles and compliments, even here in the sneering Upper West Side. Edward Riley loved the attention, which was an odd thing, really, because Edward Riley was a spy. Claiming fame is frowned upon for intelligence officers, but Edward Riley's claim to fame was undeniably impressive. He had been the youngest chief of station in the last 30 years at MI6, the foreign intelligence arm of the government of the United Kingdom. Now, at age 36, he had the experience and the CV envied by men twice his age, and Riley played this up more like his own publicist than as a spook concerned with his own personal security. As a young lad, short and sandy-haired Eddie had a love of language and culture. His parents traveled Europe as manufacturer representatives in the fitness equipment industry, and he'd been to every country on the continent by age 10. Moreover, his grandparents on his mother's side were ardent travelers who borrowed their grandson for summer hops to Africa and Asia and South America. Eddie went into Eton with plans of following into his father's business so he could continue to see the world, and he studied French and Arabic and Russian as a means to that end. He hadn't been a perfect candidate for intelligence work, because although most spies have at least some level of loyalty to their own flag, Riley did not.
It wasn't that he was unpatriotic, really. Rather, he just didn't give a toss about his own country or countrymen. But one of his professors at Eton was an unofficial recruiter for the Crown, and he forwarded Eddie's name on a hunch, and soon Eddie was met after class by a middle-aged woman and asked if he'd be interested in taking the civil service exams. "Not particularly," was the honest answer. But the woman was persuasive, and she hyped the travel and the study of culture, and within seconds a light bulb went off, and Eddie Riley realized this was a recruitment attempt for the British Secret Services. And that sounded interesting. There wasn't a James Bond film young Riley hadn't seen 5 times, so his "not really" turned to "why not?" One does not apply to MI6. Instead, one applies for a position at the coordination staff for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. This is personnel code for foreign intelligence work. Riley did this, and then he breezed through his training, and soon he was off into the world, beginning every young officer's saga of doing time at dusty outposts, learning the ropes the hard way. Sana'a, Yemen, Windhoek, Namibia, then a promotion to Montevideo, Uruguay. After he had spent a year in South America, the war in the Middle East had pulled enough more experienced intelligence officers into that region to leave some plum postings vacant for young officers who were both competent and easily mobile. He worked in Finland for a year, and then he did a longer stint in the British Virgin Islands. Riley made a name for himself, and by age 27 he was back in Europe as assistant chief of station in Bulgaria, a rising star. He'd been in that position for less than 6 months when his chief of station was recalled home due to a family illness. MI6 had plans to replace the senior spy with someone other than his young second-in-command, but a month as acting chief of station turned to 3, and then by 6, someone decided he'd earned the position he'd fallen into, and the paperwork was completed to make it official. Edward Riley of London became the 27-year-old SIS station chief of Bulgaria, making him the youngest in the service in more than 30 years. But Riley did not stop there. He worked hard, which was important, and he had no qualms about using people and situations to his personal benefit. By his 30th birthday, his skyrocketing career had landed him in Italy as station chief, a posting orders of magnitude more important than running the shop in nearby Bulgaria. But in Rome, it unraveled quickly. By violating orders and working with one group of local criminals, he disrupted another local cell of Russian mafia who were connected to the government in Moscow, as virtually all Russian criminals were. The criminals appealed to the SVR, Russian Foreign Intelligence, and the SVR developed an operation to get Riley out of the way. The Russians identified Riley as the UK station chief, and then they targeted him. Not for any lethal measures. That would have brought more trouble than the matter was worth. They just wanted him gone. The Russians tricked him, though when it was over he had no one but himself to blame. A simple honey trap. Edward had a British wife and 3 small children, but one day he sat down next to a 24-year-old Romanian model named Alina at a cafe he frequented on the Via Bergamo, and he started up a conversation. She claimed to be an exchange student, and she showed more interest in her textbook than in the handsome Briton chatting her up, but her beauty absolutely floored him, so he kept talking. He saw himself as the pursuer, so he didn't think for one moment he was being played. He asked for her number, and she refused, but she showed up at the same cafe a few days later, and they went for a walk on the Via Piave, and soon enough they had somehow wandered into the lobby of the Hotel Oxford on the Via Boncompagni. He had no idea how a credit card in one of his aliases just appeared from his wallet into his hand, and then into the hand of the desk clerk, and he couldn't for the life of him understand how he and young Alina found themselves in a fourth-floor suite on the bed. A bloody mysterious thing all around, he told himself when it was over. For her part, Alina did not know she was working for the Russians. Instead, she thought she had been hired for this seduction by a British tabloid. She'd been paid well, and the tabloid in fact existed, but Alina had no idea it was owned, like much of the UK, by Russian concerns, and it went where Russian intelligence told it to go. Even though the honey trap had been set and the paparazzi were in town to catch the young British spy in the act, it was really not quite so simple. Riley, like most adulterous spies, applied the tradecraft of his work to his pleasure. For a month, he and his Romanian lover kept a clandestine relationship that would have made his MI6 training cadre proud. They used drop phones, they met in out-of-the-way cafes only after running surveillance detection routes, they varied their routines. Alina kept tipping off the cameramen as to where they would be and what they would be doing, but Riley kept the affair one step ahead of them, though wholly unaware anyone was on his trail. On a moonlit beach in Sardinia, the cameras finally caught him. Riley and Alina were nude, in flagrante delicto, and as the flashes flashed and the shutters clicked, 31-year-old Edward Riley knew his career and his marriage were now items of the past. The British tabloid was giddy with its reportage. Photos of the topless blonde, the dashing young spy, bare-chested on top of her, staring into the lens with a deer-in-the-headlights look that solidified the sordid nature of the tryst. "On Her Majesty's Sleazy Circus," read the headline, and as Riley looked at the article the next morning, he knew he'd been had, and he wished the rag had only the decency to admit what they'd done had been done for fucking Moscow by bylining the piece written with help from Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. Riley was recalled to London, of course. He was shamed out of the service after years of work, and the paparazzi chased him and his family outside their flat in Knightsbridge. Something snapped within Riley, and he turned to self-preservation mode, not allowing himself the self-acuity to take responsibility for his action. He blamed England, his own country, for the debacle. Certainly not himself. He kept a stiff upper lip for a few months, but there's something about being the most publicly recognizable spy in your country that works against you, and Riley knew he'd have to do a runner and leave England behind. And in swooped Duke Sharps. Riley had never met the man. He knew him only by his unscrupulous reputation. Duke had asked Edward to come over for a meeting, all expenses paid by Sharp's global intelligence partners, of course. Edward did so. He'd listened to the American's spiel about the work, and he'd agreed on the spot. Edward was ecstatic to be back in the intelligence game, even in a commercial capacity. He could do unscrupulous. He'd go into it for the money, eschew right and wrong and good and evil, and look out for himself now. Of course, he'd been concerned that his new notoriety would make him completely ineffectual as an intelligence asset, but something happened that Edward Riley did not expect. He found his fame worked to his advantage. In this odd version of intelligence work at Sharp's partners, having a reputation served him well. He met the important people. He dined with potential clients and CEOs, and he appeared on television as a talking head, giving his view on UK intelligence issues from New York bureaus of the big news stations. And he made a lot of money. Sharps paid its operatives more when their operations were successful. Unlike MI6, where the bloke meeting an informant over a dinner of whale blubber in Iceland with 6 years of service earned the exact same amount as the bloke with 6 years of shooting it out with Russian Spetsnaz in a shit-stained basement in Chechnya. Though he had some shine time on TV, Riley wasn't a figurehead at Sharps. That was Sharps's job.
No, the 36-year-old Englishman worked surprisingly hard, built operations from the ground up, and put in the hours and the effort. He ran intelligence assets and demanded every bit of the same excellence he'd expected from his agents and officers when he was an MI6 station chief. Sharps used Riley on the tough jobs, and Riley didn't care. He was in it for the money, full stop. By the time the 3-year anniversary of his fall from grace came around, he took a thorough look at his life, and he realized he bloody well loved his job and his life of amorality. The crown could bugger off. Edward Riley pulled his BMW sports car up to the valet stand at the Mandarin Oriental near Columbus Circle. He climbed out and winked at the young Dominican valet as the man approached the vehicle with an appreciative grin. "Staying with us, sir," he said, nearly salivating at the prospect of folding himself into the luxurious sports car. "Just a meeting over tea at Ossiet." The valet turned away from the car. "Perhaps with the woman who just arrived by taxi?" "Tall, blonde, legs for days." The Dominican smiled. He wanted Riley's life, and he did not hide the fact. "That's the one, sir." The Englishman ate it up. "Haven't yet met her in person, but I've heard reports she is quite something. A beauty, sir. You enjoy your meeting, and I'll take great care of this beauty." Riley was a single man, if not on paper. His marriage had fallen apart in London right after his fall from grace, and his wife, one of these days he'd go home and make it official, or she could bloody well come here with the papers to sign, had herself moved on. The thought of bedding this Frenchwoman was appealing, even though he hadn't even met her yet, but this operation was too damn important for him to mix business with pleasure. He'd keep his hands to himself on this one. He found Veronica Martell at a corner table in the rear of the nearly empty restaurant, sitting with her back to the wall. She rose and shook his hand, and he gazed into her eyes and found her